Fiction and reality. New stories, new ideas. Little Beth Entertainment.
Welcome to episode 98 of The Rocketry Show at therocketryshow.com. And this one is an epic episode here. We've got a lot going on. We're joined by John Thompson, who will go over with us the changes to the NAR's Level 2 certifications. Also, we'll have questions from the listeners, including how to prepare for a Level 1 certification attempt. And we'll go through and review the happenings of CG's Demo 3 launch and review how that went. So stick around. This epic level episode of The Rocketry Show will begin right after this.
Going up in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, liftoff.
From Little Beth Media, a new podcast on model rocketry. With build techniques, model rocket history, interviews with industry insiders, stuff for beginners and longtime model rocketeers, everything from low to mid-power. The Model Rocket Show with me, the Rocket Noob, at themodelrocketshow.com or anywhere you download podcasts.
The Rocketry Show would like to thank the following patrons for their support. Timothy Mock, Jeff Curtis, Phil Bridges, Scott Masters, Roy Tyson, Rob Hoji, R. Smith, Gary Dow, Jay Poman, Don J., G. Smirden, M. Ayersman, Pierre Marlowe, Jeff Curtis, Brian Laputo, Philip Calvin, Jay Bryan, Casey Anderson, Terry Dancer, Mark Eisenwein, Jim Wilson, Jason O'Scally. If you wish to show your support and become a patron of The Rocketry Show, just visit us at patreon.com/The Rocketry Show.
Ignition sequence start. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running.
Welcome to The Rocketry Show. A podcast that is all about advanced and high-power rocketry. Amateur-built rockets, starting at mid-power to higher-power versions. This program is hosted by the team who loves the smell of burning rocket propellant in the morning. Here are CG, Gene, and model rocket guy, Jesse Yu.
Welcome to another edition of The Rocketry Show at therocketryshow.com. I'm CG.
I'm Gene.
And I'm Jesse Yu, model rocket guy.
All right. Hey, Jesse. And we're all here and back on the program again. A little bit of a delay, but that's okay. I've been busy working on just stuff in general. So, but it's all good. It's all good. We are joined by John Thompson from the NAR. And what we're going to be talking about will be the changes to the L2 certification process with the NAR, or NAR as we like to call it. We've been kind of talking about a little bit off and on in the show, and we figured, you know, let's get somebody official on here. So we have John. So welcome to the show, John.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Nice having you on the program.
Indeed.
Well, from what I understand here, the NAR is basically doing an update to the process. Fill us in on what's to look forward to starting in November.
Definitely. Yeah. About a year ago, when I first got appointed as a HPR advisor, Chuck Neff had contacted me and brought up the idea, since we have the junior high power certification process, and it's kind of like in a good academic structure format, you know, with a nice key card and stuff to help people grade the test faster. We thought we should update the level two packet that NAR had, and I thought it was a good idea. So we've been working on it, going back and forth since last year, and we also submitted to the Board of Trustee members of NAR for their review, and also the Level 3 Advisory Council for NAR, so everybody had their input. So we had a lot of feedback, a lot of good advice, and you know, some question why we wanted to change it. And one reason why is because it hasn't been updated since 2012. And since 2012, okay, a lot has changed for the better for the hobby. I mean, you have more motors to select from. You have vendors that come up with so many varieties, it's hard to keep track of. It's almost like an encyclopedia, right, in itself of just the different kind of motors from Aerotech and from Sassaroni and from Loki Technology and other vendors out there. And then you have more electronics. So we needed to update the testing packet. And also since, you know, ATF, the lowest budget user permit requirement, which used to be in effect up to 2009, you know, that went to litigation and it got lifted. So there was still some stuff in the 2012 document that talked about storage and low exposure user stuff. There's only like three or four questions in section B of the 2012 test. So it's good knowledge to know for your own safety, but it's not a requirement as a something that you need, you know, have to know as a, to pass your test. So we were focusing more on, you know, what the ruling is for, you know, when you have to have a note of an FAA clearance, you know, when does that go into effect? And that's when your rocket is actually above 3.3 pounds. And if your motor consists of more than 125 grams, that's when you're required to have an FAA license or, you know, a NOTAM, you know, submit to the FAA. Right. So, because there has been a lot of confusion thinking that if anything, you know, a G impulse requires you to do an FAA waiver. And that's not really the case. If you weigh your rocket and you weigh the grams, you know, there's a fudge factor. So that's something everybody should know. And that doesn't mean they need to take advantage of it, but
right,
there's a ruling there you need to understand. And so we focused more on that and also on the range safety, like the field requirements. Like if you have a certain impulse motor, you know, how big is the field? And if you get approached by a farmer or something that wants to offer the field up to you, you know, things you have to consider. Like if he has 5 acres of land, but his house is like right smack dab in the middle, that's probably not a good idea to have a launch, especially if they live in it, you know, so there's stuff that you have to consider. All that stuff has been updated and Chuck Neff did a great job on it. And I'm trying to represent it in a positive way. And if there's any feedback I get from him, I'll make sure to update you if there's any more changes, but those are some of the key things. And we updated the website stating key elements on bullets, which was one at the beginning on October 1st, which has already passed. You can actually go on the website for NAR and do the exam study guide. And then the packets and the certification teams, they'll be available starting October 15th. So those are already now available for you to request from the club organizations. If they want a copy, we can send the whole packet. So that way you can administer it to your NAR members that want to certify under the NAR. The 2012 and 2017 versions of the Level 2 written exam will be valid. If you, for example, I had one guy that contacted me this week saying, hey, I took the test in March of this year. Will it still be valid? And the ruling is if you've took this the Level 2 test, you have up until a year to do your flight.
Right.
Because I've had an issue last year where I had a guy that certified, he had his rocket ready to go, and then a gust of wind came over and knocked his rocket over and snapped the fin. I'm like, hey, don't worry about it. And the positive fact, you know, first you're angry, but then the second thing is, well, I realized that if he had launched it then, maybe that fin might have snapped off during flight.
That's right.
So he went back and fixed it, and we were able to certify later that year. So same thing applies if you took the launch or the test, let's say, you know, January, March, you have it until the end date that year to actually do the flight, still under the current test. But if you haven't taken the test now, I mean, you still can if you want to do the test and do a launch that same day, but it's going to change, you know, starting November 1st. And so it's better to prepare and look at the format. And then the next thing we're going to work on is there's an online study guide where you can go on there and practice. And we're going to work on getting that updated. Chuck said he's going to update that system.
Oh, kind of like an interactive online study guide?
Yes, exactly. So you can do, there's like sections A, B, and C, and D, and you can take the study, the question, and once you submit at the bottom of the online test, it'll give you results right then and there. So you can do it over and over again until you get it right. And like what I used to do, I would do it over and over again and get it right. And then I would just do a screen capture of the right answers and then grill myself over and over again until I got it right.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
So that he's going to work on getting that updated.
So that'll be announced on you guys will send an update, you know, to the NAR updates whenever that's done, right?
And there actually was on the latest NAR Rocketeer, the E-Rocketeer.
Yep.
There was a blurb on that. I don't know if you saw that or not, but it is in there.
Okay.
Yeah,
I did. That's good to know. Okay, cool.
But But we will probably repeat it over and over again until everybody gets it. But yeah, I've had people contact me this week already requesting the pack, and I've been forwarding it to them. And then, of course, there was one case where some guy didn't have a printer, so he wanted a hard copy. And if they want a hard copy, they can contact NAR headquarters because they now have a copy of it, and they can mail it to you. And then you can make copies of that. So there's a backup to backup plan.
So real quick question, just as far as like the test administration goes. So the NAR will send out packets on request from a club to administer the test. Is that correct?
Right. Like if there's a club representative of your NAR section, or you can have anybody that's designated to be the, you know, managing the testing part. They can contact NAR headquarters or the HPR services, and we'll make sure to get them a packet. So it'll be the full packet of the version A. I think there's, let me see how many versions there are. Because there's like three different variables. Yeah, you have packet A, B, and C. And that's it. So you have three different options. So if you had three persons, you know, next to each other, they can't technically copy one another because you're going to have one guy having version A, one B, and one C, and so forth. But it's also good in that aspect. So let's say, for example, if the person doesn't pass the first time, he can retake it two more tries on the other versions that same day.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's one thing we also, the one key bullet on it, we said if a member fails his exam, they can retake another version immediately. And if the member fails that second exam, then the member will wait 7 days. So technically you have two tries.
But that's actually a nice little change for somebody that might be nervous about taking a test.
Right. Yeah. In the past, if you didn't pass it, you had to wait like 30 days.
Yeah. And then I think it was a month.
Yeah. So we tried to expedite that a little bit, just one because of current situations, and also to make it easier. And like I said, if they practice over and over again with the packet, the study guide, and so forth, and you have, I remember I used to have friends of mine when I was sort of, practicing, I'd have somebody grill me, just across the room. If you do flashcards, they'll do a flashcard and test each one another and make a game of it. Sometimes that helps. And even a club, if there's a big group of, people in the club that are local. In fact, you can even do it online now through Zoom. You can make a game of it. So there's so many ways you can come up with to, make that a game. And I know there's an HTML generator that generates like flashcards. So you can test yourself on all kinds of different aspects.
You can have fun with it. Make it like Jeopardy. Ooh. You
can phrase that
in the form of a question.
I do that with my team for the junior test. Like we kind of just like, all right, guys, let's see how much you really know kind of thing. Yeah, and just then also with the new guys that are thinking about it or haven't done any of it, that'll give them an idea of what they're going to need to know. So it's useful in a number of ways.
Yeah.
And also if you're driving down to a launch and you got a couple hours on the road, maybe you guys can go back and forth, there's at least three people in the car. That might be a little bit better because you don't want to read questions while you're driving. So be careful,
tell
guys.
Me about code 1137, will you? Yeah.
Right. That's a great idea because I've been on many road trips when I was in California driving to Henderson, Nevada. That's a 6-hour drive.
Got a lot of time.
That'd be a better idea than talking about UFO conspiracies kind of stuff. But
So another update that I think persons who are going to be administering tests on behalf of their club that they might like, and this is something maybe you can chat about. You guys are going to do like a test for A, B, and C, and then you're also going to have an answer sheet. And then you're also going to have not an answer sheet, but a multiple choice sheet for the person taking the test. Mm-hmm. And then the person administering the test will be able to grade it with an answer sheet. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So this is going to be very similar to how Tripoli does it. Oop, did I say Tripoli?
That's okay.
It's a great thing for folks who are going to be administering the test, because then you don't have to sit there and go through the old guide and just make sure, that one. With people bugging you and stuff and talking to you, it's kind of hard to grade somebody's test and make sure that you're doing it right.
Right.
All of a sudden, B's look like D's and C's look like A's after a while. So
Yeah. I know the Oregon Rocket Club, they usually have a designated area and they try to get the people who want to do a certification test. When they get there first thing in the morning, they have a time and they're kind of like isolated in one area so they don't have any distractions. They can get through the academics and they can get on with their projects and seeing them succeed. So,
Yeah, so setting up a table next to the outhouse may not be a good idea. So make sure you put your people somewhere where they have some exclusivity. Yeah.
Yes.
So, but that's
good news. It looks like good updates. Really appreciate, you know, your and Chuck's work on this. And, you know, Chuck, thank you for, you know, helping us out with this.
Yeah, Chuck did a great job. And hopefully we won't have to update it for the 10 years from now. So, but it definitely made a good improvement. And it's a 32-page study guide.
Nice. There's a lot of information in it.
Yeah, there is. And it's good because when you look at the questions to choose from and as an answer, it also gives you like a point of the source of where to review. Like, for example, one on the definition of this positive stability in regards to a rocket, you know, where the center of gravity is located, where the center of pressure should be. Then it just doesn't give you just, you know, select answer A. It also says, if the rocket has positive stability, where the CG is located, and also references the Handbook of Model Rocketry from G. Harry Stein. It gives you the page to reference. So it gives you something to study.
Cool.
So if you didn't get the answer right, it also says, okay, let's, you know, wait for a minute and let's go back and pull up the source and, you know, read it together, whatever. And then, you know, I think it's a great structure.
Yeah.
And it's good for, classroom capability.
But it also is good that, you know, it's not encouraging people just to memorize things that they may not possibly understand.
Right.
They can go back and not only, well, if they understand it, they'll get it more, they'll increase their chances of getting it right the next time around too. So pointing them to the reference is great.
Yeah. So
kind of want to take the test again now, guys.
So you guys, you took out all the questions about low explosive user permit, magazine distances and stuff.
Well, they had one, it was just section B. Still pull up the link on the web, but it was section B and it was like four questions. And I was talking about like the distances and stuff like that. And now this is stuff that you should still know if you're going to go up to level 2 and level 3 and you're going to, you know, store your own stuff. But they kind of took it out of the test because the majority of them, you know, they want you to study the rules and regulations of the rockets, the weights and stuff and safety.
Sure.
So it's something that we were actually, there was a lot of talk about that, you know, thinking we should have it, we shouldn't have it. But
got it.
That was added when it was a requirement for everybody in high power status having to have a low explosive user permit. And so the ATF got involved, you know, and that was a big issue. And so, in fact, there was more questions covering that, not just the four that were left.
Right. Was that around the 90s timeline or like when did that have to...
It's been around, I think it started in the 90s. It was trying to be enforced in 1993. And I was in California at the time. And we were having, in the state of California, which I think they still have that current because, you know, once they start something, they don't want to stop it.
Wait, let me rephrase it. Because California.
Yes. So, and in fact, there was, you know, in big majority of the hobbyists, you know, live in California because it's like year-round weather for it. And so there was a lot of pushback, but, one member, I think it's with Triple E, Scott Bartel, he was the one that was trying to say, look, we should represent it in a positive light, go through the process. And so I went through the process myself, went to West Covina, had to take a 50-question test, and you pass the safety. It's basically a safety test. You had to have a California pyrotechnics license, which you had class 3, 2, and 1. And so for the basic, for high power rocketry, it was a class 3. So they give you like a nice little... ID card, looks like a driver's license with a registration sticker you have to renew every year. It's like $50 a year to renew. But that was just to show that you were a California safe rocketeer. But that was also in addition to having the ATF low explosive user permit.
Right.
Which typically you'd have that. And it was like $120, I think, for like a 3-year period.
Oh, wow.
But with that, you know, you can get that permit, but that also opens up to where an ATF guy can come and inspect your container anytime.
Yep.
But he usually calls in ahead of time. And I've had, even when I was in the military, I had a container that was, you know, Rhino line and anti-static electricity. And I had to have an inventory list, you know, what you had in the box and what you exhumed that day, expended, and what you have left. You had to keep a copy of all that. So when you came and inspected, you can see your container and match it up your inventory list. Most of the guys I dealt with are pretty nice, but I think they're kind of glad to see that ruling go. And I don't know if you've read the high power rocket magazine, or not the High,
the high book, Power the History?
Rocketry. Yes.
Absolutely. Yes, the new one.
Hard to Age of Rocket Ships. That book is awesome because I started reading that book one day and I read it like in a day and a half because I couldn't put it down. I lived half that history. I mean, I worked with, I met Frank Cosden at one launch in California. And this was after like Desert Storm. I came back, you know, when I was at Desert Storm with a friend of mine, we were like, if we get back alive, what would we like to pick up? We gave up as a kid. We're thinking rocketry. So I'm thinking model rockets, you know, like everybody else. I come back stateside. I go to a hobby shop and he says, well, you need to go out here to Lucerne Dry Lake Bed. I'm like, why do I have to go all the way out there?
Yes.
You know, to fly a rinky dinky rocket. Well, I walk out there and there's this guy with a half-scale AMRAAM missile. He's setting up all the electronics and stuff. And I'm like, oh, man, where the heck have I been? And then I met somebody, a vendor from U.S. Rocketry. I guess it used to be a partner with Frank Cosden. And there was like a altercation going on there. And I was kind of curious what that was about. So I went to talk to Frank Cosden. Frank Cosden is a super nice guy. You know, sorry he's not around anymore, but he was a nice guy.
Right, right.
I don't know if you ever experienced his motors, but when Frank Cosden's motors were very aggressive, and if you did not build that rocket sound, it's going to be just shredded on the way up. And he made...
I have some 38 millimeter J's that I'd like to launch at some point, somewhere, sometime.
Yeah, I know he partnered up with Aerotech, and they had some... They called Cosden totally recycled motors. I don't know if they still make that motor.
No, but his name is still on some stuff. I level 3'd on an M1845 Thunder motor that had his name on it. So I thought that was pretty cool. Dude.
So his motors were cool. Like those Thunder ones, huh?
Oh, they are. Yeah, they were. If you didn't build your rocket sign, it's shredded.
Yeah, okay. Got it.
And that's why I chose that motor, because I needed it. I build heavy and like a tank.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I still have some of his hardware and a couple of his reloads probably somewhere. But he made some Smoky Sam motors later on when he was trying to, I guess, distribute more of his product that was less aggressive. But yeah, I don't know where everybody else, if they had a Cosden rocket motor, they were like, oh, you got a Cosden, you know, for the hills kind of stuff. You know, make sure you have a ballistic helmet on or something like that. But nah, he was a good guy. It was funny because he always walked out there with a, you know, Bruno's tank, Bruno's shirt. And green shorts, no matter where you went. That was
his rocketry uniform, huh?
Yeah. So,
and his shoes/sandals is what I heard.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's how I got introduced to the hobby. And then I've been like in it ever since. So, all right.
So, well, back in 2016, when we became a, you know, born again rocketeer and I came back, you know, I didn't even know that there were FNG motors, you know, because I stopped launching rockets back in like 1988. Then I launched a few Estes rockets back in like, you know, 93, 94, just whatever was available when Walmart was selling them. And I had no idea what high power was. And then all of a sudden, 2016, I'm doing stuff with my nephew and we go back and look and I'm starting to look, ooh, there's Apogee. And I start looking at the rock. What is all this? You know, so once I found out that there was stuff as up, you know, and North Coast Rocketry was selling huge rockets, you know, back in the 90s and stuff. Mm-hmm. And looking at some of those old catalogs on, you know, some of those old websites, I'm just dumbfounded by how much stuff that there was back in those early days. So I love hearing the history. So thanks for sharing that with us.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, cool. There's been a long and, you know, it's been a rough road. I mean, and like I said, Gary Rosenfeld, I met him at one of the, I think it was Springfest in Lucerne. And I was kind of like, I think it was you or the Rocket Noob regime that said when they met him, they couldn't say anything. I was that same way. It's like I had cotton in my mouth or something. I saw Gary Rosenfeld and I'm like, I couldn't say anything.
Was just, that was me.
I probably looked like I was mentally challenged or something. I don't know. But
starstruck.
I felt like such a heel. But I did see him again in 2000. I was out in there at the LDRS 19. Was it LDRS 19 in 2000? That was in Orangeburg, South Carolina. I drove cross country with Scott Bartel when they had, he was the first guy to get the CTI motors from Sassaroni Technologies in Canada. We actually drove across from California, cross country. I think we listened to audio tapes of the Harry Potter when that was a big thing. Son was with us. And it's like we stopped at every Cracker Barrel from Arizona to South Carolina. And we picked up, I think, a truckload of the order of the 38 millimeter CTI motors, which was the first batch. And so, yeah, it was interesting. We were set up like right across from Aerotech at the time. And we were like their competition. But I'm glad to see that they now they have compatible parts like space.
Yeah, crossloads.
Yes, which is awesome because both products, if they combine their forces together, makes it more valuable. And I'm glad that happened.
For sure. And we're going to take a quick break here on the show. We're going to come back with more with John Thompson here. We were just finishing up talking about the rule changes for the level 2 certification for NAR. And when we come back, we're going to have some fun talking rockets. So we'll be right back after this. You're listening to The Rocketry Show at therocketryshow.com.
Hey, all you rocket geeks out there. Do you like doing in-flight videos of your flights? And do you ever use those keychain cams and unfortunately sometimes only get videos of your thumb? Hey, this is Gene from The Rocketry Show, and that used to happen to me. I used to use those old keychain cams only to get nothing very good quality. But I found a solution to that, and it's Insane Rockets. It's an app that's available on the Google Play Store for Nexus 5X and higher. Now get this, it does 4K video. But not only that, it'll upload it automatically to the cloud and provide you real-time telemetry while tracking your rocket through Google Earth. It is amazing. Available on the Google Play Store, Insane Rockets app. It's crazy. Nope, wait. It's insane.
It's time for Serious Rocketry. Serious Rocketry, since 1998, they've been providing the Rocketeer with great kits, motors, supplies, and more. They've got lots of products in their store that's always growing and always expanding. And you can check out all of these items, including all the popular Sirius kits and more. They've got plenty of kits that go beyond the basic three fins and a nose cone. Gene, you've been kind of going through the store there virtually. Mm-hmm. What have you been finding there?
Oh, well, I'm always finding something at Sirius. But lately, you guys know I've been kind of taking a little tangent in my building, going into scale and some other stuff,
yes,
like the Saturn and the X-15. Well, there's another one that I've got on my I will want to build and fly plate, and that would be the Jayhawk missile, the drone, the target drone. So Mad Cow Rocketry has one at Sirius Rocketry. It's a 2.6-inch Jayhawk. When it's got those fins on it, it's kind of got the orange and the black nose cone. But check this thing out. It's over 30 inches long. It is 29 millimeters. So you can put it, mostly flies on Fs, but you could, if you put in an F-26, you'll probably get about 1,000 feet out of it. So if you want to do that, and if you could always go more if you wanted to. It's pretty cool though, because the thing about the Jayhawk is it's got those wing fins on them, and this one has plywood. So good, strong laser-cut plywood parts.
Strong like bull.
And you get in, but the best part about it is it's a Mad Cow kit, so it gets all the stuff inside. It's got water slide decals. It's got a custom balsa tail cone, which I think is pretty cool. So you could shape that a little bit if you wanted to. I'm always a fan
of
balsa tail cones, you know. Heavy-duty, high-power type body tube. And it is going for about $93.95. So it's a cool rocket. It's good mid power, could be higher power if you wanted to beef it up, but it's a great deal and it's a really interesting rocket. So you show up at the range with this thing, you're going to turn some heads with it.
All righty. And when you're looking around for that or supplies to go along with it, maybe even a motor or two, maybe. You can go to Sirius Rocketry's website and you can tell where everything is because they have real-time stock tracking and let you order with confidence from their online store. No having to call or write to see if something is really in stock. And when you're ready to fly, Sirius Rocketry has motor and hardware in stock from Estes through Aerotech High Power, as well as popular electronics from Jolly Logic and Estes and more. Be sure to ask them about their club specials when you're visiting. And you can check out their websites today at SIRIUSRocketry.biz and .com. Serious Rocketry for the Serious Rocketeer. We have more of the show right after this.
The Rocketry Show would like to thank the following patrons for their support. JohnRocket.com, Jason Rodney, Sean Falconham, Joe S., Paul Oliveri, Sam Feinberg, Michael Aylward, Brian Scheckenberger, E. Huddle, John Thompson, Mark McBride, Doug Wade, C. McCauley, Carl Hunting, the Piedmont Student Launch Team, Steve S., Tim Hoagland, Dave Simmons, FusionRockets.biz, Jay Kirschler, Christopher Short, Kelsey Black, Brian Reniger. If you wish to show your support and become a patron of The Rocketry Show, just visit us at patreon.com/The Rocketry Show.
Welcome back to The Rocketry Show, therocketryshow.com. CG, Jesse, Jim. And Jim. We're all here with John Thompson. We were just talking NAR certification and talking rockets and things. On the topic of tests here, John, you're starting to reminisce with us about some test questions you run into.
Yeah, there was one question that brought a lot of issue, which in the old version on the study guide, it had one talk about the space for, like, if you launched a rocket, they had a combination of 3Js or 3Ks. And what the distance was, which actually I think the one answer was like 75 feet, which actually should be more, because technically you're talking about, if it's 3Ks, you're talking about an L, almost like a low impulse M, so to speak, right, on your, you know, depending on the size. So that, I think that question was taken out. We kind of streamed that a little bit, but we were trying to make sure you still got the idea what it requires for your dimensions, for safety, distance, and so forth.
That's good to know, but I mean, it's, the basic distances haven't changed. You just made it clearer for the test taker. Okay.
Right.
That's good. That's good to know.
Yeah, and one last thing I need to point out on the HPR Level 2 process is that the Level 2 written exam administrator or proctor must now be at least a minimum of Level 1 certified.
Okay.
Okay.
Just to administer it.
That's good to know.
Yeah, there was some push on that, where maybe wanted to be more at that same level, at least somebody at the same level sort of, you know, administering that. But yes, currently that's where it stands. So it's a work in progress. Like I said, we've been working on this, and, you know, Chuck more than me, because he was doing the restructuring of the test, getting this through since last year. So
the observers have not changed, though. So if you're doing level one, you need two that are level one observers. Is that correct?
I know you can use a level one and a level two and a level one. A level three person can sign off on a level two on their own for NAR, you know?
Right. Yes, and I've signed off on junior level ones for my team, just solo.
Right.
I believe you're correct on that. But yeah, that was the one thing. At least one person has to be a level two, or I mean, minimum level one certified to do level two. So we were
I do want to kind of chime in on the, why somebody could be a level one given a level two exam. Well, think of it this way. You have, you know, the senior members of your club, you know, even like a vice president or president of the club, you know, that might be the person who's giving you your test. They may not want to venture out past level one, and they're enjoying their level.
And whoever the person who's administering or doing flight, you know, they could be just level one, but they could have 300 flights. And so they have the experience, the knowledge, use electronics that have been, you know, from adept all the way up to missile works on the electronics, and he probably maybe does Arduino or Raspberry Pi or whatever on programming. You know, he has the background and the credentials to say, look, I can administer the test, because it's just a test. So I think that's what their aspect was. But I think it's also because the amount of NAR members, you know, we have look at the percentage of how many people are level three and level two certified as compared to level one, there's quite a lot. And like you said, there's people that could be at zero that have been in there for 20 years because they're happy where they're at.
Absolutely.
But it's a definite improvement, and I'm glad it finally went through. It's funny because we've been dealing with this for a year, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, it's going to the field. It's going to be out next month. I'm like, what? And it's like really bad. So I'm like, okay. So cool. And so I've already gotten, you know, replies, and I sent out the packets to get people ahead of time to study. And like I said, I have a couple of guys who are trying to certify this coming weekend on the current level two packet. Ahead of the November 1 change.
Yeah, the last two weekends we had some folks do their certification on the 2012 test, you know, and one of them, this is something, I don't know if this is new or not, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but they can email you those now, right? They can email these tests and certification packets to NAR instead of just sending them snail mail. Is that correct?
What I normally do is I would, like, if they finish the results, you scan it in as a PDF file and email it to NAR headquarters. And they've, as far as I know, I've done that, and they've had no problem with that. And they've sent the people their certification updates. It seems to work quicker than snail mail.
That's great.
Absolutely.
It's good to know. Thank you, guys.
Yes.
I mean, and sometimes I've been redundant where I would do a, email it and I would also send it and then I get a reply back. So you don't have to do that. I'm like, okay. But
I did that on my level two and I got the same, hey, that's great that you did that, but you don't have to do it. So I'm like, right. Oh,
that's funny. Yeah. So they're trying to streamline it, which is a definite improvement. Because, sometimes the stuff gets lost in the mail, literally. Email's the best way. And, of course, if they were everyone's like, yes, you have a copy of it, you can keep on file just in case they need to touch base and say, hey, send me a copy of the exam or whatever again, then you can gladly do it.
Yep. And then they can save that 55 cents from postage and use it towards rocket supplies. So
there you
see,
go.
The NAR saving you guys money right away.
Yeah, because you're going to need it.
Yeah. Exactly.
So, I mean, as long as I have a quick opportunity, I'd like to say we're talking a little bit about history. And I'm a born again, just like Jesse. And I came back into the hobby probably about 7 years ago. And I went all the way up to my level three. I just got that two years ago. So 5 years, I just been rocking into the stars. But it was so easy for me to go through the process because guys who have some history, I had an opportunity to meet and work with them and learn things from them. And then I found out about all the stuff in the early days, like with the ATF and the explosive users permit and all this other stuff. And I just like to say a quick thanks to everybody that did all of that legwork and did all of that lawsuit stuff and went through that pain and suffering, because coming into the hobby, I didn't know anything about it. And I was able to just do the hobby. And thanks to all the people that put the effort in to do that. Your legacy lives in us now, and we intend to carry that on to the generation that we're bringing up. So just wanted to say thanks to all you guys out there.
I agree. And, there's a lot of locals here in Colorado that have told some stories about all that too. So, appreciate all your guys' help.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a quick shout for that, because it's just funny, these stories, just listening to you talking about Lucerne, Dry Lake and everything. And I'm thinking about some of those stories that were in that book that I devoured in like 2 days too. And I'm reading it a second time now. I'm trying to glean into it. And it's just great listening and hearing the stories and actually talking to the people that were there. So I get excited about that.
I get starstruck, meeting people like you guys talking about too. You mentioned Gary and, standing there starstruck. And, when I first saw Gary, the same thing happened to me. And all of a sudden, Scott Kormeyer from Loki was one of the ones that I keep telling the story about. I had an issue with my forward enclosure, and that's before they put snap rings on there. We had an older forward enclosure. So I go over to my vendor, and Bob from Mile High Rocketry, he's like, okay, well, let's go ask Scott. And I'm thinking to myself, I was like, okay, so it must be somebody that he knows. So I walk over, and Scott Kormeyer is answering my questions about Loki stuff. I'm like, wow, I never, ever thought I'd get to see you in person. And just, that kind of stuff is kind of dumbfounding. You get to see everybody behind the hobby. And like Vern Estes, when everybody's, that's in rocketry, is at some point seen or met Vern. It was kind of funny because I'm over at NARUM 60 in 2018, and Jason Chamberlain's standing right next to me. He's like, hey, there's Vern. Just like nothing. I turn around, I look, and I just put my arms out, and the guy turns around and looks at me, he puts his arm out, and he gives me a big old hug. It was like, honest to goodness, like a comic book hero, like meeting Stan Lee himself. That's how
that's exactly it. That's a great way to put it, because you turn around and there's Galita and Vern, they're just there at the launch, and it's like, wow, that's cool.
So it was a fun story. Thanks for sharing all this, John.
Oh, no problem. Yeah, that was kind of like me. I shared a picture, I think, with CG about when I was at the NARCON in 2018. I had like 5 hours to kill before flying on the connecting flight back stateside, back to Washington. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking through local websites near the NARCON, and there was like one in Webster, and they had a picture of a guy. There was a carbon fiber tubing and a carbon fiber nose cone in the shop. Like it was one of their Windows things. So I'm like, if it's there, I'm going to get it. So I walked over there, and I got it for a really inexpensive price. It was somebody who moved from Texas to Florida. So I was getting that boxed up when I turned around, and Lee Peischer showed up with his wife at the hobby shop. So I was like, oh, so I had to get a photo. And it was funny because there was a guy that came in like maybe an hour before that handed me an old G. Harry Stein handbook of model rocketry, and it had a picture of him in there, and I should have gotten his autograph. But I didn't think about it at the time. I just got the photo, which was, golden in itself.
So absolutely.
Yes, I used those parts and made a upscale version of the first rocket I ever got, which was an Estes Icarus. So now I have a six inch diameter, 10 foot tall carbon fiber Icarus with the clear tube, which I don't know if you've seen Jeff Dunham, the comedian, the guy that has the ventriloquist.
Right. Yeah.
I have some of his ventriloquist characters, and I was thinking about putting one of them in the clear tube, maybe. Or a parachute.
Okay, this begs the question, how thick is that clear tube?
It's pretty thick. It's about a quarter inch thick. I can send you the link, but there was a company that sells clear tubes, probably for chemistry or something, and they sent me like it was probably a 5 foot section. So I got another half of that still that I cut down to size, but that's about a quarter inch. So I'll put some reinforcements in it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that'd be fun. I got it set to go on an M1315 eventually.
Nice. You got to put a frog statue or something in it, you know, just to throw back to the old days.
Yeah, definitely.
So now that we're reminiscing here, I'm thinking we've got an interesting question from a listener here. And with all the experience in the room, I think the collection of us can give this listener a great answer. So from our SpeakPipe feed, here's the question here.
Hi, guys. My name's Charlie, and I just found your show here a couple days ago, and I just want to say that I love it and I enjoy listening to you guys. You guys make it fun and it's very informative, and I'm learning tons that I didn't even know about. But my question is if you guys could do a show or a segment on getting prepared for your level one, not only mentally, you know, because it's obviously a big step, but also to make sure that your rocket is prepared and you're prepared physically for your level one certification or any certification for that matter. Just the steps and any kind of tips that you can give someone such as myself that is getting ready to do that. I'm going to be shooting off a 4-inch Lock Goblin at Argonia for their Distant Thunder launch that's going to be coming up here in another month, and just getting prepared and trying to figure out what I need to do. But I just figure I'd come to you guys and see if you guys had any tips. All right, thank you.
You know, that's a very good question, because anybody who's going for a certification, especially the first time, we all know the nervous jitters you have, and the second guessing and all that. And I would say my first comment is that nervousness is a good thing.
Because
once you're all calm and think, yeah, I got this, that's when something goes horribly wrong. So I'm gonna chime in here with what I've learned, and then I'll let you guys go on in there. My big thing, and I've heard people say this over and over again, and it's true: checklists.
Yep.
Yep.
The more checklists you have for this, the better off you'll be. So I would make one for when you're building the rocket, things that are important that you need done. I would make a checklist so you can check through it as things are completed on the rocket. And that I learned the hard way. And also a checklist for packing everything up that you need.
Yep. Oh, there you go.
Because nothing sucks worse than thinking you've got everything and you drive all the way out to where you got to go and you're missing that one thing and you can't launch. And flight day checklist. So the checklist for everything you need to prep the rockets, you know, make sure you have your starters or initiators, whatever you're going to have it, and the right kind of things, and all the ground support and launch support things. It's invaluable. And what I've discovered makes a great tool for me is, and there are all kinds of options, but I happen to be on using Microsoft OneNote.
Okay. Yep.
And it's kind of goofy, but you can make checklists and make templates out of it. And the goofy part about OneNote is that you have to use an older version of OneNote to make a template of a checklist.
You can use Google Keep too. I use Google Keep, I have that on my phone, CG, and I can do the checklist. So, you know, if you guys...
Yes. Yeah. There's all kinds of options, and Gene, you can chime in with what you like to use.
I just use Notes, Apple Notes on my iPhone. So, and nice. You can do things like you can compose it on your computer and have it go up to the cloud, so it's right there on your phone. So that's what I like.
Yep.
So basically, what I do with my template is I call up a new one, like I'm looking at my Demo 3, you know, pre-flight checklist, and that's when I'm leaving the house. So I just make a new page, and it automatically fills in all the tables with the checkboxes. Nice. And as I get things together, I hit check, got that. Put this in, check, got that. And then before I drive off, I can run through the list and make sure I've got everything. And then, okay, good to go and drive off.
I just thought of another thing that could work pretty well is Office 365 Excel. You could save it up to the cloud. Make yourself a spreadsheet, save it up to the cloud, and then you've got it on your mobile device. And that reads on Android or iPhone or whatever.
And that's exactly the same thing OneNote does. It uses a subset of Excel where you can basically use, you know, spreadsheet tables to make a checkbox.
Yep.
Oh, there you go.
And so, and it saves to OneDrive as well, so I can have it on the tablet, go out to the field and, you know, verify and make it, you know, whatever. You know, it's if you can have things that sync to the internet, if you're lucky enough to have a field close enough to a site to get internet service, otherwise, it'll work offline. So that's my big thing. And for, you know, I didn't think I had so much to say on this, but build checklists when you're building the rocket. Now, I learned that the hard way with the first attempt at a level one for Nezuru. And that when I was building it, there was a couple things I needed to remember to make sure I did, because the areas that need to be finished were in places that weren't obvious to look at. And for some reason, I had it in my head that I filled in a hole that I drilled in. And what I did is I put a little piece of HVAC tape over that hole, with the idea being that I would fill it with epoxy and then I could take the tape off or whatever, or leave it, didn't matter. But that hole needed to be filled because there was a hole I drilled for something and I changed my mind. And so the tape was on there. And for some reason I figured, oh, I did that already, so I'll just leave the tape on, it's not hurting anything. So on that flight, it happened, and where the main parachute was supposed to happen, it didn't. Uh-oh. And the rocket just crashed on the ground. And so I go out there and get it. It's like, huh. And I look at the data and I saw the straddle lugger did initiate a fire command. The charge was blown. It's like, well, why didn't it go? And luckily it had a camera on it, so I can hear that it went. And so, okay, it went off. Where did the pressure go? And then I looked around and I saw a hole punched through the tape where obviously the pressure blew it inwards towards the avionics base. So it went to pressurize and the tape gave way and it depressurized to the electronics bay. And that was all because I forgot to put the epoxy in that one hole. So if I would have made a checklist for myself, I would have said, oh, you didn't do that. And that would have had my level one attempt the first time around. So I don't know, you guys can chime in from there, but that raised a whole flood of things in my head there.
You know, I think the Lock Goblin 4-inch is a fantastic airframe for a level one attempt. You've got nice big fins. It's going to be stable in flight. It's going to be maybe 1,500 feet or so, so it's not going to be too high. Exactly. You always hear low and slow for a level. All you want to do is get your rocket up and get it down and stay within your comfort zone. If you are...
Gene, that's boring. I went for dual deployed electronics.
So did I. But I was comfortable with that because I had dual deployed on F and G motors for 2 years before I tried to do a level one with an altimeter.
Same here.
That was my comfort zone. So, but if you're not familiar with all that
good
stuff, best thing to do is, you know, get it up and get it down. And if you can borrow a chute release from somebody to do kind of a nicer deployment, if you feel comfortable using that, great. If not, then you might walk a little bit, but you're not going up that high that you're going to risk, you know, especially in Kansas, you should be fine. So
agreed.
You know, just that, do your simulations. That, go ahead.
I kept interrupting you. All I was going to say is yes. If you're new to the level one thing and you're new to all this electronic stuff, what Jim says is the way to do it. Low and slow, get it up, get it down. So yes, definitely good points. I wanted to reiterate that because I chimed in being...
Well, you know, it's like, and everybody has a different comfort level. Like I said, I got back into rocketry and I was using flight computers and electronics on low power stuff just because I thought it was cool. and then learning about the charges and deployments. I was dual deploying on our low power field with G's for a couple of years, just because, and everybody's looking at me going, what are you doing? And I'm like, I'm dual deploying. Why? I'm learning this stuff. So
it's funny they questioned you on that because there's a track record of me doing that with F motors.
I did the same thing. I followed in your footsteps essentially. So, but you know, people were just curious about it. Really. They weren't like, you know, saying, what are you doing?
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But they were,
how dare
they're like,
you?
Wow, that's cool. You're dual deploying. I'm like, yes, I am. But if you do feel comfortable doing that, by all means, but just take it and enjoy it. The other thing that is a big takeaway, that because I have a TARC team, and I throw the carrot out there for junior level ones through NAR to my guys. Mm. And I always use single use motors for those guys. Okay. Now, I've built motors many times before. I've had my share of Kato's and whatnot. And we all have. But a single use motor is one less headache for you if you're not real comfortable loading a motor. And there's a great line of Aerotech single use motors. There's an H182 red line that's a favorite of my team because they like the red flame on it. And it'll definitely take that goblin up and down nice and easy. And with that, though, just make sure that you run a sim and you know what your optimal delay is so that you can drill out the delay grain as much, you know, to match, because you don't want that to be too long or too short. You just want it somewhere in the middle. So if I think that the delay grains are 14 seconds typically on those single use motors. So just make sure you put it in around 10 seconds. I found with my guys seems to be the sweet spot for the H182 redline if you're going to do that. But those are my two pieces. What do you got, Jess?
Oh, geez. I'm going to rewind a little bit, and we're going to talk about why you want to do this.
Cool.
Okay, so one of the things that I learned when I was studying to do my level one, I literally walked into Apogee, saw all the big fat rockets, because if you go into Apogee, if you live in Colorado, or if you're visiting, they have a rocket for everything that they sell, which is really nice because you can put your hands on it, pick it up, hold it, and look at it. So I'm over here looking at the G-Force from Aerotech. You're looking at not Lock Goblin at the time that I did mine, but they had a Lock 4 that was sitting there. And, you know, bigger fat rockets. And that when I did my level one, that was back in the Mega Duredmax days. Everybody had to do the level one on an MDRM, which is fantastic. And a lot of people did that. But now you can't do that because it's not readily available unless you want to spend a ton of money or see if somebody can make you a good clone. But that's hard to do now because I don't think Estes has those nose cones. So now you got to look at different options, right? Okay. So I didn't want to do it on a Mega Duredmax because I wanted to save that and build it because that was going to be a showpiece, because you kind of know that, you know, when someone's going to discontinue. So what has been outstanding that has been there forever? I picked a Lock 4 because after doing my homework, which is something you definitely have to do when you're studying your level one, I found out that the Lock 4 was a big fat rocket that weighed the right amount for an H73J. And that's what I used because it was a black motor. Okay. And that big, thick black smoke on that rocket, it's still one of my favorite launch videos that I ever took. And I literally went up to the front desk and was like, what do you guys recommend for a level four? And Sarah was working there at the time. So those of you who, you know, have talked to her in the past, you know, she's not there anymore, but you know, you have other good people at, you know, Apogee that can help you. Well, she's like, you know what? I just sold this to this guy and he picked out this motor and I'm starting to look. And you know, she was right on track with me because Jim, just like you said, there's a lot of disposable motors that are available, but I wanted to build my motor.
Sure.
So I'm like, well, I have a few dollars. I can, you know, I can buy a casing and look at a couple of reloads. What do you recommend? So we start looking through the great old Apogee's website and start looking at the chart. And then we looked at the availability of the cases and the enclosures and the motors that they had on hand. And we chose that H73J. And that same day I walked out with that motor casing, the motor and the rocket. And, you know, I was able to do my level one in September of 2017. You know, it all went haywire from there. That, you know,
always does.
So you all know what we're working on now. So, the first thing is, one of the things that Tim Van Milligan will tell you from Apogee, you know, and the reason I talk Apogee guys is because it's local to me, right? It's nice to be able to go into their store and actually talk to these guys. Well, one of the things that he said to me was, it's a rite of passage. And then we start looking at, you know, the work that you put into a rocket, we have a lot of scale builders out there with the LPR stuff. We have a lot of scale builders who do the HPR stuff. I mean, look at Stevie, who set, you know, set records with that Saturn V, right? I mean, so it's all across the board. So this is your rite of passage to getting into the bigger motors. So everybody can fly up to a G motor, you know, except for like the, you know, the metal storms or whatever those might be. But you see what I'm saying? You can get your level one and start going into H and I motors. You know, does that have the 160 impulse that you need, you know, to put up these bigger 4-inch and even 3-inch rockets? I mean, I think a noob used a Leviathan or something like that for his level. What did you use, Jim? You used one too, right?
No, I actually used a Madcap Torrent dual deploy for my level one.
Okay. Yeah, and see, that was one of the rockets that I had on my list here. So I apologize for going on a tangent, guys. Let's rewind a little bit. The rite of passage that you get, you know, some of the rockets by other manufacturers other than Estes are specific to high power. So when you start looking at other rockets, you know, in the catalogs and everything, you got Lock Precision, you have SBR, you have Binder Design, you have Mad Cow, and there's a plethora of others as well, right? The certification, why do you have certification? Well, the certification allows you to buy, you know, to buy and fly those bigger H&I impulse motors for the level one. Doing your level one and, you know, going through the certification process, it technically is a really fun way that the NAR and AAA is able to govern the rules of, you know, the high power flights, you know, if you have the field and, you know, the ability to do that. The rules are in place so that the persons who do fly the high power know what to do and they're ready before going on to their next, you know, J, K, and L with their level two certs, right?
Right.
One thing that I do recommend is low and slow. You know, if you're flying your rocket, like you were just saying, Jim, a Lock Goblin is a great rocket. I'll go through a list of other rockets that people this year have certified on, you know, that I've been talking to and helping out from my local clubs. I would be careful, guys. You know, we have a lot of, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say it. We have a lot of college students. We have a lot of first-time rocketeers that will fly a 2.6-inch cardboard rocket on like an H550. You know, it can be done. Yeah. I've seen some people do it. They recover it. The rocket's fine. Mm-hmm. It looks great, but, you know, it's going to go out of sight and you're not going to see it. And for your first higher power flight, you might want to rewind just a little bit, you know, and go through the... what's the way I want to say this? You know, go through the certification process. You know, I just want to make sure that people understand that it's good to keep it simple. You know, don't think you have to go fly the biggest H motor that's out there. You know, a 550 is ridiculous. You know, I haven't even flown one yet, to be transparent with you all. Jim, I'm probably sure that you have though, you know.
Oh, yeah. So,
all right. So Apogee, actually, I'm going to quote something that they had here because it means a lot to me and it's something I wanted to share with everybody. Certification process is designed to educate modelers about the current government regulations and the necessary safety procedures for flying bigger rockets. If everyone follows the same rules, that will keep the hobby secure for generations of modelers. You know, that speaks a lot to me because one of the things that I like to do with, you know, being on the Rocketry Show and, you know, having Model Rocket Guy as a, you know, platform for social media is to get more people into the hobby. And I can't tell you how many people that I brought into the hobby just this year alone because of COVID and everything. It's a great hobby and we want to make sure that we're going to be able to participate in this for years to come. So that means a lot to me. And that's one of the reasons that, you know, I like to make sure that people, you know, just kind of go through the steps. One of the things that I like to tell people to do is fly up the ladder. If you get the ability to do so, fly rockets from A through D, you know, lower power stuff, because, you know, we still do it. I mean, I have thousands of kits here and I love, you know, flying D motor rockets and even, you know, fly some E to G's and get some mid powers, get those 2.6 and 3-inch rockets up in the air. But I recommend highly to everybody. And, you know, Charlie, I've spoke to you a few times and everything, but, you know, I understand that you haven't done this, but don't skip level zero. There's technically four certification levels in, you know, NAR and AAA. There's level zero, which is your, you know, your smaller, you know, A through D, and then your, you know, E through G motors. When you start playing with level zero, I mean, look what CG and GM are talking about here. They've done electronics. They've done some dual deploy stuff before even getting a level one certification. So it was probably a walk in the park for you guys, you know? So, you know, don't overthink things. Keep it simple, you know? One thing I like to recommend to you guys too, build your rocket per the directions, especially if you're getting into high power for the first time. One of the main questions that we always hear on the threads and groups is what glue do you use? I used epoxy. It was like the third rocket I ever built with epoxy, right? Because I literally took a bounty hunter from a North Coast Rocketry and I built that with epoxy as my first rocket because I was like, how the heck do you do this? So I figured it out. And, you know, a lot of people are saying you can just use type bond, you know, two or three and be fine. they're 100% right, because I built some lock rockets with tie bond, and you know what? I can put those on H and I's all day long, and they're lightweight. They go higher. I mean, you got to find what your preference is, right? But when you're doing your level one certification, you know, follow the instructions. They're there for a reason, you know?
And John, any advice?
What do you think, John?
Well, my biggest thing is make sure they know where the center of gravity is going to be with the motor in, where it's going to be after the burnout. I mean, I know that's a stable rocket and it's pretty straightforward, but it's a good learning curve basically to, you know, look at the rocket as like it's your own design, even though it's a kit. And I do old school. I actually have, in nowadays, since you can actually get the motor ahead of time, I believe.
Yes.
Or you can make a weight that's similar to the weight of that motor, but you can put that in the rocket with all your, if you're using electronics or your parachute and the recovery wadding, have all that stuff in there and do like a weight to figure out where that CG is going to be at market. Because a lot of times when you're, another club that I go to, or one of the clubs I go to, they have a very, strict RSO or inspector. They inspect the rocket.
Sure. Yep.
And they want to know not just what the weight of your rocket is, where the center of gravity, the center of pressure, but they also want to ask you what's the thrust to weight ratio. And normally you want to have a thrust to weight ratio of 5:1. And some people go, what the heck is that? So there's good tools out there that you could look at to have like a checklist. And that was one thing I brought up, which I've been promoting in our club, was basically I have these log books. And I saw this through the Australian Rocket Club. Because the Australian Rocket Group in Australia, they actually sell these little logbooks, and they kind of make it mandatory, like a flight logbook. And
anybody's
been a pilot, and you know, you want to get your hours in, I think that should apply to the rocketry group. But I know a lot of people do it for fun. They have their own logbooks. But it would be good to have that as a perk, as part of a member of either NAR or Triple Lead, where you actually get that as being a member. And it's not very big. You can put it in your hip pocket, but it's a little logbook where you can record all the pertinent data, you know, your information and your NAR membership. Record key rockets. Like if you're going for level one, make sure you log that in, because later on, if you want to go for level one or level two and level three, and if you want to go for being a TAP member or a level three advisory member later on, the one thing they're going to ask you is what's your credentials, what's your background. So it's almost like a resume. Right. So if you start now with like a flight logbook, recording your first flight for level one, that's going to just replicate further down. And it doesn't have to be for every rocket you do, but for the rockets that are actually critical,
significant.
That's good, significant, because they also want to ask you, well, who certified on your motor, who signed off on it. And so the logbook, I'll send you a soft copy, just an example, could be totally revamped, you know, to your club's specifications, but it also has a place where the RSO stamps it that or signs off on it saying you had a successful flight.
Yeah.
But it also has information where you can put your person's the information of who signed off on your certification. So that way you know them later on. So if you ever have to contact them later for credentials, they will remember you and you'll remember them, because and especially in the hobby, it's not what you know, but who you know.
Yeah.
And that goes a long way, because I mean, I know today's current world events, it's very stressful for a lot of people. And I mean, I could say we're living on borrowed time, but, people that you, it's people that have a lot of knowledge, you know, we don't live forever. And I mean, I felt bad years ago when I was deployed. I came back and a club member that we had had passed away, and I never knew it. And, so those people, you know, are valuable. So it's a good thing to start the logbook from the get-go, and it's going to replicate later on for your other successes.
One thing that I would like to mention real quick is do a simulation. There's sim programs out there. One's free called Open Rocket. There's also Rock Sim. There's a couple other ones out there, SpaceCAD. But do, and you can get a file that is already pre-made for a rocket, probably from Thrust Curve or Apogee Components. If they sell that rocket, they will have a RockSim file for it. Do yourself a favor and do a simulation on your rocket and make sure that the weights of what is simulated are the weights of your actual rocket, because that gives you your center of pressure and center of gravity in the program. And it'll also give you, depending upon the motor that you choose, the basic estimated altitude of what your rocket's going to do during that flight. So you could kind of already know beforehand, well, I'm probably going to do about 1,500 feet on this H-182. So that's always good to have that, because if somebody, you know, the RSO should ask you, where's the center of pressure, where's the center of gravity on this rocket? And you could, knowing, you could, if you could print out a copy of that simulation, you go, well, it's right here, and according to this, this is what it says, and I made sure that all these weights are the same on the simulation. Or you could just put a mark on the rocket like a lot of guys do. But simulations are fantastic because it gives you an idea beforehand of what your actual rocket will do. And you can put in even things like different weather conditions or wind speeds, and they can be very accurate. If you put the data in, that's accurate, you'll get something that's pretty close. As an example, when I did my level 3, I used RockSim, and I simmed out on an M1845 to go about 6,600 feet, and I got 6,400 out of it. And it was a little bit more windy than what I'd done in the simulation. So it actually worked out very well. So that would be my advice. Yeah. Use the simulation software.
Yeah, another good thing, piece of advice is make sure you put like a label on your rocket, like a tag, because if you ever lose your rocket, you know, if found, please return.
Yes.
I saw something that was interesting through the AMA. They actually have stickers that you're supposed to put on your aircraft, which has, you know, your, what do you call your unit, your identifier?
Yeah, the tail number or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But it also, it's funny because the sticker says, warning, this thing is highly flammable. And if you do not return this to the rifle owner, federal, you know, you'll be federally prosecuted kind of stuff.
Nice.
Which is kind of like, in, you know, in threatening, but you don't have to do that. But they should have a label on there, because I've had that several times where I launched a rocket and I had, the only thing it saved is I put a return label on. Somebody found it and called me and said, hey, we found your rocket. And, you know, you ended up striking up a conversation, you know, because sometimes they want to classify rocketry as fireworks, which then you can gladly explain them when it's not. It's a hobby, and highly educational, and actually invite them to a club meeting. And sometimes you might have a new member.
You know, exactly.
It happened a couple of times. So
that's true.
Yeah, there's been a couple of funny situations where people talk about checklists. I did a certified level 3 on an M1419 launching a half-scale Phoenix missile, which had like 21 pounds in the nose.
Did you say 1419? Yeah.
Yes.
That's to launch one of those around November-ish.
White lightnings are my favorite. Yeah. But I certified with that. And then I went back, I think 2 years later at Lucerne, they did a drag race. They had 5 rockets going up at the same time on M motors.
Oh, jeez.
And nice. Yeah, I had a drogue to Maine. My thing was straight and true. But I didn't have a checklist, and I forgot to take the duct tape off the main chute. But the drogue chute was really big. So it came down just faster, but the rocket was fine. Mm-hmm. But it's more of just the principle of the matter. I'm like, why didn't the main chute come open? I opened it and looked at it, and the tape was still wrapped around it. And I'm thinking the tape was not that strong to prevent the parachute from deploying, but it was. So having a checklist is always good. And then there's also several examples. There was one guy at one of our California launches that had a rocket that had 1,500 LEDs. Beautiful.
Wow.
Night flight. And he forgot the army electronics for the recovery. So... So
a pile of blinking lights was left.
Yes. So it was a beautiful rocket. But yeah, the checklists are meant. And, you know, when you get to level 3, you know, that's part of the package. You want to have a pre-flight checklist, a post-flight checklist. So if you start looking at that now, starting at level 1, level 2, and you start practicing that process, once you get to that point, it's, you know, it's easy, smeezy. It's like secondhand. And there are so many, you know, complex things that require checklists just to make sure you successfully do your mission. It's a good practice.
If you ever end up being a mentor or a coach for a team, that is the thing that I am drilling into my kids for checklists. They had a TARC checklist, and they had it, and I'm glad they did, because they were nervous when they were in that ring for the final flyoff, and they went down the checklist. And if they didn't have that, one of the guys told me, he's like, I'm so glad we did that checklist. I was really nervous, and I know I would have forgotten something without it. So
that's, you know, the
words
key
of advice.
That's the key. When you're nervous, there's nothing like a nice, cold, calculating checklist to keep you in check.
Well, you think about it. I mean, doing a level certification, I don't care if it's level 1 or level 3, it's nerve-wracking.
Yes.
Because it is kind of a rite of passage, and you feel like all eyes are on you, because, and all your friends are rooting for you. You know, I've got a buddy, Andrew, who's going to be doing his level 3 shortly, and, you know, he's chatted with me a couple times about, like, oh, God, I'm really nervous. I got family coming out. And he said, okay, get your checklist. You'll be fine. fine, you know. Yeah. And he's an experienced guy. He's done it like more than I have, way more than I have. But it's a nerve-wracking experience. So the best thing to do is just, you know, enjoy the tension, because that pucker factor, if you don't have the pucker factor, then something's wrong.
Right.
You know,
you're not doing
if you're
it right.
Just gonna,
totally agree there. Yeah. If you don't have that pucker factor, there's something wrong with you. But I mean, that's
seriously.
We got a new rocket term, everybody. We got a new rocket
pucker
term.
Factor.
Yeah. Oh, that's like an old term around here, but if you guys want to use it, feel free. I'd be honored.
We're gonna. That's good.
Yeah.
And another thing too, I'm sorry.
No, you're first.
Another thing too, everybody, if you're, you know, you guys have heard me announce here on the show, and you know that I have this date, I got sick. I got sick. Mm. It turned out that I wasn't ready.
Yeah.
I had two different plans that I submitted, an A and a B. You know, I decided to go with B, and I'm still kind of sticking to B. And if you're not ready, don't rush yourself. Be ready, right. Guys, and just take your time.
Yeah.
Be happy and enjoy your build.
Yeah. That's it. You know, because it's a process.
Yeah, it is. You just take it from A to B, or you go from front to back to forward. You know, you make sure you have not just a rocket, but all the logistics and the supporting stuff you'll need to get that rocket successfully up properly. Yeah, take your time.
I think the fact that the question's been asked, that's a good sign.
Yes.
You know, good luck with your flight.
True.
And hopefully this will help you out a little bit. But, you know, at the bottom line is also enjoy it, because you're doing this because you want to do it. But enjoy the ride, because it's crazy. And once you get that certification, enjoy that level for as long as you want. I mean,
yes.
I know a lot of flyers that are level zero and they're happily flying rockets, and I love them, you know. And some guys are level one, and that's where they stay. So, you know, if you choose to go on, you can. And if you want to stay at that level, there's so many motors on level one that, you could spend years there. There's CTI and Aerotech, and just there's so many different propellants. And these days, there seem to be more propellants coming down the line. You got these nice, long 13-second, H's, or want that.
Yes.
Or the half-second, blink and it's gone kind of propellant. So that's the range that you've got. And it's enjoy that level, because there's so much that you can do. And that's the beauty of this hobby, is if you want to go higher, you do. And if you don't, then you don't. And you still have a good time. And at the end of the day, you're all sitting around talking about the flights that you had at the end of the day, when the range is packing up.
Yep.
Yep.
All righty. Well, thanks for coming, hanging out with us, Sir John.
Yeah, I'm glad to help. I enjoy talking rocketry. It's, like I said, it's I live for it. So I'm glad
don't
to
we
hear.
All?
Yeah.
And real
really
quick,
appreciate it.
And as we close out on this break, I'll leave you with this piece of news that happened in between episodes here. The Triple E Motor Testing Board, they approved and certified a new motor from Aerotech, the K76WN-P, single use 54 millimeter motor, has a total impulse of 1350 Newton seconds. And a burn time of a little more than 20 seconds.
Oh,
there you go.
Wow.
A 20-second K.
Oh, man.
Congratulations, Aerotech.
Hamster dance will never be the same.
I was going to say, that's a West Coast motor, man. I don't know if I could fly that around here.
Yeah. That's awesome. I'll get my hands on one of those.
There you go. We'll leave all you guys savoring that one there. So thanks, and we'll be back with more of the Rocketry Show right after this. And thanks again, John. North Coast Rocketry, one of the first high-power rocketry kit companies ever, takes advantage of over 30 years of high-power experience by a world-class rocketeer. You can look to North Coast Rocketry to expand your high-power rocket fleet. In addition to great kits, North Coast Rocketry also stocks lots of must-have items and accessories for every rocketeer's workshop. Find out more about these kits and other great products today. Go to NorthCoastRocketry.com. And while you're there, don't forget to get their latest catalog, NorthCoastRocketry.com. Advanced rockets that are easy to build, fun to fly, and look great on display. It's time for eRockets.biz. eRockets.biz is your home for unique model rocket kits, as well as the world's largest selection of rocket parts from Semrock. They've been around since 2009. So they know how to do rocketry, and they've got it down. And Jesse, you've been looking around and seeing what's going on in their store virtually.
So yeah, I have. If you guys have listened to the show, know that I'm, you know, trying to figure out what I want to do after level three. Mm-hmm. So I was taking a look at, you know, doing some more high intense builds, and I think I found one that I've been looking at e-rockets for. This is going to be the Altera N1 moon rocket.
Wow.
You know, okay. The Soviet super booster rocket. Now this particular kit, I've seen a few people who've built it. And, you know, this one here comes with a apparatus, you know, the motor mount you can do with 6D motors, or you can convert it to a 29 millimeter. Okay. It's going to be kind of iffy, but I think it might be something I want to try. But, you know, I'm all about aesthetics when I build stuff. I mean, that's, you know, some of my rockets have been used on Flash for some of the stuff that you guys have seen before. So I kind of want to build this and build it as strong as possible with as much detail as possible. So looks like E-Rockets has these in stock, you know, 34 inches tall. So it's still a big boy, you know, 1/122nd scale, laser cut details, different vacuum form pieces, lots of wood pieces, a 40-page instruction book. And, you know, if you look at the previews of the instruction book on E-Rockets, super detailed, super fine, pictures for everything. So whoever built this for the pages, you know, took pictures, and I can't wait to get dirty with it, I ain't gonna lie. And E-Rockets has it. So yeah, this is what we might be going with, folks.
Tell me how that goes. Well, when you pick that up, we need photos of the build process for this one.
Yeah, these photos for the instructions look amazing, so I can't wait.
And E-Rockets also has they've got some great news as well. They've got a new location. They've moved to 1510 Springfield Street in Dayton. And so that's right down the road from the Air Force Museum, and that makes it a great destination to go and visit E-Rockets personally to see that big. So I saw their old location, and you go with a heavily armed wallet, because you're going to come out a lot lighter when you see what all they've got.
So go to the museum and then go visit E-Rockets on a Tuesday, right? Hopefully they do their build nights that night, right, CG?
Yes, that's the other thing. They do build nights and gatherings. They're not so much now with the COVID, but after that all goes calming down or goes away or gets cured or whatever, hopefully soon, because we're all getting a little tired of being locked down. But once we're free and able to go to E-Rockets on their build days and hang out with other Rocketeers and build rockets and have a great time there. So also, they also have the largest selection of parts from SEMrock. So if you're looking to build a rocket, check it out, erockets.biz. And you can find out more by going there. Erockets.biz. If rocketry scares you, buy a train set. Lock Precision Rocketry manufactures a full line of high-quality precision fit components to meet your building, repairing, and customizing needs. Lock Precision believes in making rocket kits as light as possible while maintaining the strength required to fly with commercially available motors. Lock Precision offers a wide range of rocket kits from the 1-inch diameter Lock 1 series to high-power rockets reaching 7.6 inches in diameter. When you visit lockprecision.com, be sure to check out their performance series kits featuring such designs as the Black Brand 10, the Caliper ISP, and the 3.1 inch diameter Iris rocket. All of Lock Precision's performance kits comes with everything you need, including pre-slotted airframes, high-grade precision cut plywood fins and components, as well as ripstop nylon parachutes, rugged shock cords, polypropylene nose cone, and instructions. The name Lock Precision has been synonymous with mid and high power rocketry for over 30 years. Check out lockprecision.com to find out why. Lockprecision.com. Fly higher. Fly lock.
The Rocketry Show would like to thank the following patrons for their support: Todd West, Matt Tudor, Les Rayburn, Steven Spencer, Bill Cook, Jason Cook, Gary Rosenfield, Greg Ziegler, Toby Vanderbeek, Ken Blade, Eric Hamilton, John Beans, Scott Halla, Guy Wadsworth, Phil P., Tom Rum, Jeff Cottis, Stephen Ray, Amanda Hope, Steve Sainer, Mark, railbuttons.com. If you wish to show your support and become a patron of The Rocketry Show, just visit us at patreon.com/The Rocketry Show.
Welcome back to The Rocketry Show at therocketryshow.com. And before we jump into anything else, let's go back into our mailbag because we've got quite a few listener comments that came in through SpeakPipe. So let's get another one out the way here and just kind of work our way through it for the next couple episodes. This one comes from Kirk.
Hey, guys. An eternal problem that always faces the rocketry enthusiast is where do you go to find a new launch field? That is, what are the attributes that make up a good launch field? Is it dimensions? Is it clearance from power lines? Trees, the lack thereof, away from people, or close to urban areas? What is it that you should consider when looking for a new launch field?
Quick answer, all of the above, right?
Yes.
Yep.
So, well, you have to decide like whether you want to be just low power or if you also want to include the possibility of high power, which involves some other things about getting waivers and all that other stuff. So that's a whole different animal. If you go to the National Association of Rocketry website, they give a pretty good rundown of what the requirements for a field are as far as dimensions go. And, you know, so the technical stuff is pretty well covered by them. But the real key is once you have an area that's secure is actually getting the landowner or the person or the organization in charge of that area to allow you to do it. And that requires a little bit of finessing. Now, whether that be in a diplomatic sense or a literally knocking on the door, introducing yourself and explaining what you're doing to something that could be drawn out over months of kind of popping in and saying hello or, you know, doing something like that. So it's really up to the landowner. As far as high power lines, you know, just follow the safety guidelines with that. There's the field that we fly out of, our low power field, does have some power lines that are nearby and some houses, but it's well within the confines of a model rocket size field. So, yes. So that would be okay. But obviously flat and no trees would be the ideal situation. So,
which in urban settings are kind of hard to find. So if you're going to have a field somewhere that might be big enough for model rockets to fly in, you're going to have other obstacles around being, you know, an urban setting. Our club has a couple different fields that we fly from, and one of which is not really in an urban setting. And this is the one that Jim is referring to. It's sort of like it's like a development, but it's got this weird parcel of land in the middle of the development area where it's used for farming. And the farm, and the piece of land we're on, the farmer willed the property to the city for recreational use. You know, so that's how the city got a hold of it. So the city has been using it for model airplane and for the rocket club use. Mm-hmm. So the club kind of lucked out with that. So it's kind of in a weird spot where there's not a whole lot around there. And that's really lucky. That's kind of an urban setting that could have very easily been a bunch of subdevelopments or just warehouse buildings all the way through there. So, right. But you know, that's kind of a rare one, but usually you're going to be out somewhere where there's more farms around and more open land. And that's kind of where another field we've located that's a little bit bigger, but not high power, not big enough for high power, but it's big enough to be able to comfortably fly G motors and know you're going to get them back. Mm-hmm. So that's a secondary field that we've got that we've also fly in now. And that's at a small airport.
I was going to say, that's a small airport where I went down there just to check out the field one day, mm-hmm. and there was skydivers and RC guys and a rocket launch all going on at the same time. So it was busy.
Yes.
But it was okay. The landowner had a chance to meet and thank him profusely for allowing us to be there. And there were some launch fees that the officers of the club will take and give to the landowner as part of the deal that had been arranged. Mm-hmm. So he gets, you know, the landowner gets a little bit of money out of it. But the most part though was he is an aeronautic enthusiast. Everything that goes up in the air, he's all for. So that's a big plus.
Yes.
you know your landowner. And this guy loves things that fly. It's just that I had a chance to chat with him, but a very colorful guy. I think his grandfather was a barnstormer and, you know, aviation goes way back, got into the RC stuff, likes rockets just because they're fast, you know, the whole nine yards. So, but keeping that relationship is always a plus too, because the worst thing that you want is to have a landowner who's either ambivalent or hostile to you.
Yes.
Because that's just a matter of time before you lose that field. And I'm sure that we've all had situations or heard stories about that and in your various clubs out there.
And another situation with a field for, well, I guess you can go with the high power field and then I'll chime in on that.
So as far as like going for a high power field, that it depends on what part of the country you're in too. Midwest, where we are, is typically finding a farmer that has a fallow field or an area that's big enough. And again, if you go to the NAR website or AAA website, there's dimensions that are provided for proper distances and where buildings, how far away buildings need to be, any kind of occupied spaces. So usually you're looking at some plot of farm. Out west, that may be a little different. Jesse, you might know a little bit more about what it's like out west. So if you want to chime in on that.
So over in the Denver area and wherever you have like a lot of mountain ridges and stuff, there's always a ton of valleys. And, you know, some of the places that we have in Colorado, such, for example, is Tripoli, Colorado. They fly out of Hartzell, which, you know, is owned by a landowner, just like you're saying. Apparently it's a big buffalo field, so you can literally see buffalo roaming around, you know, where the buffalo is. Anyway. But apparently they've been launching there for over 20 years, and the launch area is, you know, good enough for high power rockets all the way up to, you know, I think 15K. I can't, you know, I apologize. I've never been there, as ridiculous as that sounds. And I think the main reason why is because we have other launch areas that are, you know, centrally located and about, you know, 2 to 4 hours away from each other. The club that I usually fly with is, you know, G Power and Under. And that's what we consider a low power field. And that's a site that we're actually potentially going to lose.
Mm.
And, you know, those of you that followed us on, you know, Facebook and, you know, my Model Rocket guy and, you know, our crash website, all kind of are aware of that for Colorado. We're still working with the city of Lakewood and, you know, the park department, just make sure that we can probably continue to go there. But I'm not sure what's going to wind up happening because of this year and COVID and, you know, all the fire bans that Colorado's had. We haven't been able to launch. So it's making things a little bit more difficult, because if you don't have that history of launching successfully in an area, it's hard for you to go and talk to other people that own different parts of land, right, you know, closer to a city so that you can get into a club. However, we have two other NAR sanctioned clubs that are trying to get into, you know, Wyoming and, you know, just closer to, you know, some of the more metro areas. One of them is 303 Rocketry and the other one is the Longmont Rocketry Club, which is also trying to open up a sister site over in, you know, just right off of Cheyenne. So thanks to those guys for at least trying to get something done. But as far as our launch site goes, it's really been hard for us to find, you know, something that matches where we were to begin with. Now the higher power clubs, they all have, you know, the restrictions set up by, you know, the whatever they call in for the NOTAM. For example, Pueblo Score, where NARAM 60 was held back in 2018, mm-hmm. that has an 8,000 foot waiver. SLV Rock, which, you know, the San Luis Valley Rocketeers, that club is in Alamosa, Colorado, which is 4.5 hours away from Denver. So it's a hike to get out there.
Yep.
So it's, you know, you just got to work with whoever you have. And we have a really good hobby town down there hosted by Matthew Abbey. And I believe he owns that, actually. I apologize, Matthew. But he is the president of the club for rocketry. So rocketry is one of his main hobbies. And we have a lot of hobby store owners that, you know, use rocketry as their major. So he was able to get NSL 2020 scheduled to go out there. And, you know, of course, we all know that got delayed. So, yes, you know, NAR is going to continue to do that in 2021. They have now a 12,000 foot waiver and potentially mm-hmm. are going to be nice. Able to raise it to 15,000. So that's going to help out a lot of the, you know, high power stuff for the national sport launch. And we're really looking forward to it. I was just at that field this weekend and it's amazing. But it's a hike. I mean, you know, 4.5 hours to drive in your same state is a lot. And, you know, I'll do it because, you know, I love rocketry, but, you know, we're lucky to have so many clubs in Colorado. Some of the other clubs that are really widespread are the ones that you hear all the news. You know, you have Lucerne Dry Lake, you have, you know, the clubs just right outside mm-hmm. Las Vegas, who's launching this weekend. You have the clubs down in Arizona that you have really, really big openings. However, a lot of people have been closed because of fire bans. You know, we all know that California has been kind of bad, Oregon, and all the way up into Washington, you know, having to deal with a lot of stuff. So, you know, we have some clubs that are still trying to get other sites, and it's becoming difficult just because, just like you said, Jim, you've got to know your landowner and you've got to be able to make sure that there's no flight path over that area. I mean, everything is so right. high commercial anymore.
Yeah.
So
that's the big thing
everybody's dealing with.
Yeah. Exactly. If you're going for high power, you have to I guess the way that I would look at it is, if I had to go and find a launch site, I would scout around the area, drive around, or look at Google Earth, or, you know, however exactly. you want to do yep. it. And find.
And that's what some of these guys have been doing, is Google Earth. You're exactly right. Yep. And then you do the investigation of the flight paths.
Do the investigation.
And then you can go stock to.
Yep. And then that's going, there's all kinds of websites that'll give you traffic and whatnot for commercial and otherwise. And you can find out.
Good
now,
suggestion.
Now, NOTRA actually is pretty close to the Cleveland International Airport. But they have a 5,000 foot waiver, which, you know, it's not bad, you know, and it's a good field. And the landowner's been there for years. So good friend of rocketry. So at that point, it's scout your area. Know where it is, and then find out as much as you can about who might be willing to offer the land. And sometimes it may require a little launch fee, or, you know, some kind of gesture on the part of the club,
right.
which has never been a problem. But, you know, so you always want to make sure.
Yeah, be open with your owners, and, you know, see what kind of arrangements you can come up with, for sure.
All righty, very good. And before we get on out of here, we should probably do a follow-up on some of the stuff we talked about last time on the show. And the biggest topic was the Demo 3 launch and how that went.
I was going to say, those flight computers are coming along pretty nicely, aren't they?
Yes, and a lot of cool stuff there. Last episode, we left you hanging on the pending Demo 3 mission. And actually, that launch happened the same day the episode dropped. So lots of cool stuff there. So yes, it happened. It was a very, very windy day. Not really very windy day, but it was a day where the winds were gusting to the point where it was teetering on the edge of the safety margins. So Chris Pearson, Tripoli, Northern Ohio, was kind of like ready to shut it down, you know, scrub everything several times, but then it would die down and, you know, then they'll resume.
Oh,
but
yeah.
then. And then it'll pick up to the point where he's like on the edge of scrubbing it again, and then it will die down. So it did launch. This time around, Kelly was on mission control because Andrew was unable to be there, and as were you on. You were unable to be there as well. So
that is correct.
So she got to be on the mission control for that flight.
That's cool.
We had a range of things on Demo 3. So there's new code in the flight computer to gather more information from the GPS satellites, as I said. And we also were doing a second run through of the Apogee deployment code and a new mission control monitor to test out, which was a little bit brighter. And,
nice.
And also make sure that the telemetry link was stable for that mission. How did it go? Well, the flight was pretty good. I mean, the winds were kind of windy, so the rocket kind of kicked off into the wind a little bit more, but after it got up to speed, after about about 150 feet or so in the air, it straightened right out when it hit peak out at velocity. And then it went off. But so we didn't quite get the height we were going for. Maximum altitude on that flight was 1,240 feet, which was several hundred feet lower than the last time when it was more of a straight-up flight. The deployment event happened at 1,175 feet.
Nice.
So, and which was kind of interesting because the first flight was more straight up and down. It was a lot closer to Apogee that it deployed, but on this one, you can tell that it was going pretty fast sideways and dropping. So
it was it was premature, or was it after the Apogee?
After the Apogee.
Okay. Good.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's a good point because you could read that in such a way that the deployment happened on the way up. No, it hit 1,240 feet. And it started very quickly dropping downward, and then the deployment charge. By the time the deployment charge went, so that was pretty cool. So those were the basic data points of that mission. When the rocket got to the ground, it landed like closest to the pad out of everybody that day and all the wins. So it landed right there. Chris goes, oh, you get the closest to the pad award. Then another gust of wind kicked up and caught the parachute and dragged it off into the soybeans in a really, really rough ride across the clearing into the soybeans.
Now, that's interesting that that happened in an Ohio field, because I know that that happens out west quite a bit, you know, out in the playas, you know, where a big bird comes down and the parachute drags it through the desert.
Yes.
But so that's interesting that that actually happened in an Ohio field. It can happen, but it's not as common.
Yeah, so basically what ended up happening was the rocket came down and the parachute was just on its way to being totally deflated. And the wind came in at just the right angle across the ground and reinflated the parachute again. It's like, damn it! Well,
was there any damage to the airframe?
Just a lot of scruffs and scrapes on the nose cone. My makeshift motor mount for the holding in the H-180 motor, with the rocket being pounded around, like the booster was like pound, 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 pound all the way out there. Mm-hmm. And so by the time I got it at the soybeans and all that, and picked it up, I walked back to the tent with it, looked at it, and it's like, oh, where's the motor? So I was like, oh, I hope it didn't pop out at apogee. And then I was thinking, well, it probably didn't. So my guess would be that motor mount thing probably came out when it was pounding around. And the other clue to that I almost forgot about was just before, you know, when I was getting launch prep, I went to put the initiator, however you want to call it, but I'm going to call it initiator, into the motor. Yeah, starter, into the motor. It didn't want to go in. I'm going, what is up with this? I've never had this problem with an H-180, and it just still didn't want to go in. So we just tilted the rocket down, disassembled the motor right there. And here, the rear, the fiber disc for the seal at the rear end of the motor, somehow when I was putting it together, somehow got folded.
What?
And it was buried, you know, half of it was buried down into the grain and the other half was sitting where it's supposed to be. We were kind of like, that's weird.
Really?
It's like, okay, yeah, I do remember some resistance on that, but how the heck did it fold over like that? That was weird. So the club member of our club, MTMA Wolf, he was out there, so he goes, give me that. So Wolf goes off somewhere. He brings it back to me mostly flattened out again because I was having a hard time flattening out. So I don't know what Wolf did because I was looking at the rocket. But it's like, okay, it was a little bit of a bend in it. And, you know, and seeing that those guys built their own motors, they're like, yeah, it'll be fine. So we put it back in and put it in there. So that was my first clue because I had to undo that motor mount to get the motor out and in, which is like a really goofy way to hold it in. Sort of like one of those clips. But I didn't have an actual clip for that. So I've been flying it that way. So, you know, so my assumption was, well, I couldn't really get it torqued down like I normally would back there at the pad. So it probably just fell out while I was bouncing. So I went back to the spot where it landed and just walked, and about two or three steps later, there was the motor sitting there, motor casing sitting there. So I was like, oh, good. So I brought that back. So, but I did, as since then, when I got it back to the shop, there's a couple of modifications I made to the rocket, and one of which was to put one of those Rocketarium motor retainers on it. So
okay, yep.
That's not going to be a problem now. So a lot of the testing was around the base station this time around too. I said, I had the GPS going and sending back timestamps from the GPS, you know, as synchronized from the GPS satellites, and that stuff was working great. And we were trying out a new monitor where I had a Raspberry Pi bolted to the back of the monitor. And even though that was brighter than the laptop, it was still it could not compete with sunlight. So, so once again,
yeah.
So, you know, Kelly was relying on the LCD screens like you were on the receiver box. So I figured, okay, that's one thing that's going to go back to the drawing board. So, so my solution to that now is, well, let me, before I get to the solution, let me get to the conclusion. So, so the flight was a success. Everything checked out. So now we're ready for the next phase of the flight, which is getting some basic data logging running on the base station side of things.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So I've got an, SD reader and it's coming. So I'm going to modify my base station to be able to plug an SD card into it. So once it's going and it gets a new signal, the idea is it starts a new file on the SD card and starts logging, you know, as soon as it sees the rocket moving, it'll just start logging what it sees, all that data.
Just a text file kind of thing?
Yeah, it'll be like a flat text file with probably comma delimited stuff. or I might just have it just spit out the raw data for this time around as it comes in from Rocket, and I can definitely decode all that later, which is probably where I'm leaning, because it's just less work and for this part of the test. I mean, that's all I really. I just need the data from that so I can. That way, that means I don't really need to have all that stuff on the screen there going. I can look at it later and make sure everything works.
Yeah, that would be good for like post-flight analysis, I imagine.
Correct, exactly. And then the idea is all that data will come down, including the timestamps from the rocket's GPS.
Right.
So, you know, when in a flight that stuff happened. The other thing I got for the base station as part of the next test is a real-time clock module for the telemetry base station too. So that way it could do its own stamping if it needs to, you know, if I want to have it and compare notes between the two.
Cool.
What's the next thing? Oh, so yeah, there's that. So that'll get around the immediate need for the screens. And the other part is that I've been thinking of a way to modify how the data is displayed on that little LCD panel. So what I've come up with is that on the main screen, it'll tell you that, you know, of course, the current and maximum altitude would always be there, you know, whatever it's going on at the moment. But the next two lines, rather than showing you that data that's, you know, like the temperature of the rocket and the battery and all that, I figure I put that on the GPS side of the screen because that's really what that's about. You could check it before launch and make sure the battery voltage looks good. And then say, yeah, we're go. But on the main screen, it'll be the status of the main and the apogee charge, and, you know, statuses. So current altitude, maximum altitude, and statuses of the pyros. So as the rocket's going up, it'll tell you which one's arming it, which one's armed and ready to go. Mm-hmm. When it deploys, then it'll say, okay, apogee deployed at and then the height there. And it'll tell you that the main is armed and ready to go, and then what height that the main was. So that's how I'm just gonna have that information switch out. And I think that'll go great for people who want to play mission control, and then we don't need all that other stuff. And the other thing too is I'm gonna have the mock locking code just running on there just to see if it works. So it won't actually do anything yet, but I have a feeling it's gonna be fine because I was running around in my head, and the calculations for determining when it should go in and go out ended up being pretty simple to figure out. So, but I'm just going to have it just say, you know, it'll tell you when rocket's going up, it'll just tell you mock lock for, you know, and then when it comes out of mock lock, then it'll arm the pyro for the apogee. So
nice little safety there.
Yeah. So that's the one thing that, you know, it didn't have up until this point. So if you were to put in a big rocket, it's like, ooh, but I don't need to go mock one for it to, you know, for it to work. Ideally, you don't want to be in Mach 1 already to do Mach lockout. That's already too late.
True.
So for the next mission for demo 4, it's been exciting because I've got the next generation flight computer, the Block 6, or technically Block 6B flight computer, which is actually starting to look like a final product. And
I saw some of those pictures that you've been posting. Pretty cool stuff.
It's a little smaller than the other flight computer and much lighter because it's all the microprocessor and everything is all on the main board. There's no kit boards anywhere now. So that part, exciting. And I've been playing around with it, poking with it and testing it out. And so far it looks good. So,
yes.
And there will be memory on board, non-volatile RAM on board that flight computer as well. And for the idea is as I'm playing around with logging with the ground station and get the formatting and the data that I want down, that will be a subset of that or more detailed version of that will live on the rocket. Because there's where the rocket's going to have way more fine-grained data, you know, on board to tell you what's been going on. Whereas the ground station, because I'm not running the link at full speed just so I can get maximum range, So the rocket's computer is running a lot faster than when it could tell the ground station.
The transmission, right.
So that's what's coming up with demo 4. So demo 4, I have that new flight computer in there and the mock locking test. And and then after that, it's going to be, things get interesting after that because the modification to Comanche starts is taking shape, as well as Aries being in play now, because this board is smaller and I've got the, you know, the microprocessors on the board. I'm going to be redesigning the GPS now to get rid of the kit board off of that. So the GPS board itself will be no bigger than the GPS module I'm using. So that those two changes right there take out a lot of real estate in the payload bay. I mean, it becomes a lot smaller, which means Aries, I don't have to modify anything other than the AV bay in Aries, but it's going to be the same length. It's going to look the same. The way it goes together is going to be just like that new scheme I was showing you where I've got the couple of tubes with the board in there and they slide into the airframe. So Aries will be the same thing. And so Aries and or Comanche, which depending which one I get done with first, will be free to do a full dual deploy test with my flight computer. So
nice. Looking forward to that one.
That's amazing work, CG. Seriously.
Why, thank you.
Just kind of listening to you guys talk about this and just looking at the photos that you have. If anybody's interested, you know, if you're friends with CG on Facebook, he's actually got his Block 6 on there. And I've got the picture in front of me right now. I'm kind of looking at the small revisions. And yeah, everything that you're saying, as I look at this visually, it's really, really cool. So congratulations, man. This is awesome stuff.
Thanks. And if you want to see the pictures, I will post them on the show notes page at therocketryshow.com. And I'm going to force myself into a new convention because I've not really mentioned our show notes much because they're not easy to say on the show because it's like a long extension. But I'm going to start putting the episode numbers on those. So so this will be episode 98, I believe.
Sounds right.
So
did you say 98?
Yes. We are flirting with episode 100. Oh, well, we'll get to that in a second. So it'll be therocketryshow.com/98. And you can look at the pictures of the flight computers and anything else we want to show you that we're talking about on this show. But getting back to the episode 100 thing. So there's a couple of milestones happening here. And I was hoping it would work out where the timing would be one episode ahead for this. Whatever, it's not going to happen that way. That's fine. But our next episode will be starting our season 7.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, so our sixth birthday is actually today. This part of the show is being recorded on the 14th. So it was 6 years ago today that Jimmy and I posted the first episode of the Rocketry Show.
Wow. Hey, little point here. It's also my birthday too.
Look at that. October 14th is the show's birthday. So the next episode, this is like the last one of episode of season 6. So the next episode will start season 7, which will be a couple weeks from now. And these shows, we record them over time. If you wondered, so there's different parts of the shows that are recorded at different times. So this part you're listening to now is being recorded on the 14th.
happy anniversary of the Rocketry Show and happy birthday, Jim.
Oh, thanks.
Today's your actual birthday? Sorry, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep. Oh, I took the day off and painted a rocket.
Look at that.
Yeah, that's how you do that.
I did. I was just like, you know, I'm just going to do it this time. Just a little me time. That's about a 7 foot tall, 5.5 inch airframe. Good size. So I got a couple of rattle cans. I'm thinking about just a kind of a crazy design. So it's like purple with a fluorescent orange and fluorescent green and some silver metal flake stuff. And I'm just playing with it, just having fun with it, just going to bling it out. And so I had to get some paint. So I'm going to get my little cans of Krylon or wherever I'm going. And it's actually Rust-Oleum. And so I get there and I'm looking around. I get all my colors together. I'm like, this is going to be obnoxious. I like this. I need more bling, shiny. And my eye caught this stupid little plastic handle thing that fits on a spray can. And it turns the spray can into a gun so that you can actually spray with a can like you would with a sprayer.
Huh.
And I'm sitting there looking at this thing. It's like $6. I'm like, you know what? I hate rattle canning anyway because my finger always gets tired on the big rockets. So I'll give this a try, see how it goes. And for that $6, it is amazing. It latches onto the can where the lip is and you get a little handle and a trigger. And you can just spray. You take the can, you can shake and spray and shake and spray and keep going through the whole thing. it made this job almost a pleasure because you guys know how much I love painting, right?
Yes. But,
it came out really good. I was able to put three coats of base coat onto this rocket in one day, which I've never been able to do before. It's just because it went so smooth. I couldn't believe it. And it could be the paint too, you know, whatever. But I swear to God, the $6 little trigger thing that fits on top of a can, it's like one of those things you find at the dollar store, mm-hmm. but it actually really works pretty well. So for me, I'm going to probably from now on keep on using that. I'm going to pick up a couple of them. So they're just little triggers that have a handle. And it's so much easier to control the can with it too. It's a pretty good stuff. So there's my pro tip for today of what I found in my travels.
Well, that's I'm gonna have to look for that. I've got some painting to do.
I'll take a picture of it and send it just so you guys have an idea of what it looks like. But it's a stupid little thing, but it made a world of difference for me today.
Nice.
I think pro tips are something we have to kind of include in the show since, you know, everybody's got their little thing that they use that nobody has probably ever thought of. So
for sure.
All right. I would have laughed at this, you know, like a couple of years ago. Ah, it's a bunch of garbage. It's not going to work. Blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? I'm open-minded these days.
Very cool. And you heard me mention in the last break by the time before we hit to the mailbag here. That we've got episode. Well, we've hinted to the fact that episode 100 is coming up.
So for
episode 100, we've all decided as a group that we've got to get all of us together for that one, and make it a nice big show to talk about something. So the Rocket Noob will be joining us for episode 100, and he'll be talking about the Model Rocket Show with us. And yeah, he can let us know how he's been doing with that, you know, and cross promote and all that fun stuff. And if you haven't already listened to it, check out the Model Rocket Show, the Model Rocketry Show, modelrocketshow.com. Sorry. And that's where Daniel is. And it's not disconnected from this one. It's all part of the family of rocket programs we're putting together for you. We just decided that that Daniel's and his talent didn't really get used much on this show because we're so busy talking about big stuff. So the Model Rocket Show is a great way for him to talk about his specialty, which is that, and also gives you another avenue for the Model Rockets fans, you know, and not just high power rocket talk all the time. So that show is Model Rocket Talk all the time.
And it's very entertaining. I mean, it's, you know, it's the Noob. So he's always a pleasure to listen to. I love listening to his show. It's great stuff.
So we'll be talking to him more on that on episode 100 as he hangs out with us. And we'll talk about where we're headed with things in general.
Yep.
Alrighty, so there you go. That was another great episode down. And thanks for our listeners for sending a couple of questions that we were able to really stretch out the show with. So, man, just think, you know, 6 years ago, Gene, when we recorded the show, we were like wondering, man, it was tough doing that half hour long episode.
Yeah, what are we going to talk about?
yeah. How are we going to fill this time? And now look at us.
So. It's been a wild ride, but it's been fun every step of the way. Everybody that we've met, all the people we've talked to, all the opportunities that we've had from this, it's been a wild ride. Love every minute of it.
Let's hope for many, many more. So
indeed.
All right, everybody, on that note,
keep your eyes in the skies.
All right, everyone, you have a great one. We'll see you next time here on The Rocketry Show at therocketryshow.com.
Have a comment? We'd love to hear it. Send them to mailbag@therocketryshow.com. If you enjoyed what you heard, don't forget to check out our sister show, themodelrocketshow.com. The Model Rocket Show is hosted by the Rocket Noob and is all about low to mid-power rocketry. themodelrocketshow.com with Daniel, the Rocket Noob. Check it out today. The views and opinions expressed on these programs are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Little Beth Entertainment or its sponsors.
Before we leave, we would like to welcome and thank our newest patrons to The Rocketry Show. Todd West, Scott Masters, Jason Rodney, and Sean Fockingham. Welcome to the group of patrons on The Rocketry Show, and thanks for your support. If you wish to show your support and become a patron of The Rocketry Show, just visit us at patreon.com/The Rocketry Show.